Are we all set up for audio, or is there anything else you need to do?
Yeah, no, we should be good.
Okay, thanks. Okay, good morning, everybody. We have a great show for you this morning. We have a session on the implications of the consumer consumer experience, and we have three fabulous papers in this session. The first speaker will be Kyle Murray from the University of Western Ontario. Our second speaker is Tony Hernandez from Ryerson, and I'll be the third speaker if there's any time left. So we're running a little bit late, so, but the decision was to cut into the subsequent break a little bit, so each speaker will have about 15 minutes. And I'm sorry I forgot to mention, we also have a distinguished discussant, Jack Goodman from BMW Mini Cooper, who will hopefully comment on the papers a bit and offer some of his insights and reactions to this work. So without further ado, Kyle, take it away.
Thanks, Gerald. Thanks for coming to the session this morning. I was joking with some people yesterday. I always enjoy coming back to Alberta, but I left about 2 years ago. I left Edmonton. And since then, the Oilers have won the Stanley Cup. The Eskimos have won the Grey Cup. The economy's just taken off. So I'm always happy when they let me back in.
I'm going to be talking.
You're winning the Stanley Cup this year.
Yeah. So I'm going to be talking about some work that I've actually done with Gerald Hoible at Eric Johnson at Columbia University. I changed the title a little bit from what's in the outline for today. But essentially, this captures what it is that we've been looking at. We've been interested in personalization, consumer learning, also firm learning about consumers, and how that affects loyalty. So if you've been in marketing in the last 10 years, it'd be pretty hard to have missed the sort of trend towards and push towards one-to-one market. And this includes things like personalization, customization, essentially making a product for individual customers based on their preferences. And this is a quote from Peppers and Rogers, who are often attributed with kicking this whole movement off. And they argue that enterprises or firms that learn individual customer requirements and then execute on those requirements can create a literally insurmountable barrier to competition. And you don't have to look very far to find this sort of notion in the popular press or in books or even in a lot of our classrooms. And yet, more recently, there's been some question about how this works and how effectively it can work. And the notion with personalization in particular was that we would ask people what it is they like, what their preferences are, how they like a product design. So do you like a blue car with a big engine, or do you prefer a red car with a small engine? And then make the product according to those preferences. What we know, though, on the consumer research side is often consumers' preferences are very unstable. That is, just because they tell us they like the blue car with the big engine doesn't mean when they go to buy a car, that's what they're going to buy. In fact, very small changes in the way we ask people about their preferences or the context in which they make buying decisions seem to have a very large impact on the type of choices that they make, at least under some conditions. So to give you an example, Gerald and I did a study a few years ago where we asked people who were interested in the study in buying backpacking tents. And we asked them either about durability, how much they cared about the durability of the tent, or how much they cared about the weight of the tent. What we found is, depending on which one we asked them about, which of those two attributes we asked about, that was the attribute that they came to put a lot of weight on in their decision making. So we asked people about durability, they bought tents that were more durable. We asked people about weight, they bought tents that were lighter. Maybe even a more striking example is a paper by Mandel and Johnson a few years ago. They were looking at online shopping, in one case for sofas, and they changed just the background wallpaper that they had in the store. So if I remember this correctly, essentially they had pennies in one condition, and so one group of people saw a store that had pennies as the background wallpaper. They found that those people would buy or tended to prefer couches and sofas that were cheaper. In another case, they had a background wallpaper that was clouds and sort of gave a cushy, soft sort of feel to the website. And people shopping on that website tended to buy sofas or couches that were more comfortable. And so because of these sorts of phenomenon, Simonson has argued that it's very, very difficult to do personalization because we can't elicit stable preferences. And because we can't elicit stable preferences, then we can't really build products based on those preferences that people are going to be happy with. So what I want to talk about today is sort of a different type of personalization that doesn't necessarily require us to learn a lot about the preferences that consumers have, but instead just looks at previous behavior, behavior, what people have done in the past, and uses that to make sense of what people are going to do in the future, and makes the world sort of easier for the consumer in future purchase situations. So the notion here is that the firm actually learns something about the consumer or the customer, and they use that information to facilitate learning for the customer in the future. So they make it easier for the customer to learn by learning a little bit about the customer themselves. So that, I don't know if that's entirely clear, so I'll give you some examples from personalization in the wild. Expedia.com, for example, when you want to book a flight, once you've been there more than once, once you book more than one flight, they use presets from the previous bookings that you've made to create help you with your future bookings. So things like where you want to sit, do you want insurance, who do you travel with, what's your home airport, those things all become presets the next time you go to book a flight in Expedia. Because of that, it's a lot easier the second, third, and fourth time that you book a flight than it was the first time. A lot of hotel chains do something similar, remembering what kind of pillow you like, maybe whether or not you need a king-size bed or double beds or whatever it might be. And they use that information to make it easier for you to stay the next time. One of my favorites is are pizza companies that when I call them, they just know where I live, what kind of pizza I want, and have my credit card information on file. So the whole conversation to get a pizza takes about 20 seconds instead of the 5 or 10 minutes that it might take if you had to give them all that information every time. So why is that important? Well, I'm going to step back and talk first about what we found in previous research when we looked at how consumers learn and how that affects preference. Then I'm going to talk about how personalization, the role of personalization can play in that process to make it even easier for consumers to learn and even easier for them to complete the buying process. So essentially, to go through this really quickly, what we found in the past is that as people acquire skills or learn to interact with a retailer or in many cases an electronic retailer, it makes it easier for them to do so again in the future. Because it's easier, because that ease of use has increased, a switching cost arises, making it hard to go to a different retailer or a different website in the future. And as a result of that, you get more and more loyal customers. So let me maybe show you an example conceptually. So let's consider this is product A, this could be a website, this could be a cake mix, this could be any sort of product that over time you learn and become better and better at using. Right? So the first time you use this website, Amazon.com, or you make a cake with this kind of cake mix, it takes quite a while. There's a lot for you to learn. But down the road, somewhere, you get to the point where you're making the cake or you're using the website to buy a book as fast as you possibly can. And you can't really improve on that time anymore. You become very efficient at using that product. Then what we're interested in is now you're faced with a new product, product B entering the marketplace. And what we found is that how easy it is for you to switch from using product A to product B can be a powerful determinant of whether or not you make that switch. So this is the ease of use argument that I was talking about. So for those people who find it really easy, in other words, switching from A to B doesn't slow you down, doesn't make it more difficult, it isn't hard to switch, they're relatively indifferent between A and B. But in many cases, because there's differences, the two products trying to differentiate themselves, switching from A to B means that you slow down. And at some point, as you slow down here, you become locked in to product A. Because the cost of switching from A to B has become large enough that you no longer are willing to try B or to use B. A is just so much easier. And so this is sort of what we found in previous research. What we're looking at and what I'm going to talk about today is the effect that personalization can have on this process. So personalization, in the sense that the company learns a little bit about you as you're learning about the company, makes it easier for the consumer, for you as an individual, to become more and more efficient, faster and faster. And maybe ultimately, it becomes easier to use because of personalization than it could be otherwise. So again, just maybe look at this conceptually. Here's a product, a learning curve for a product that's not personalized. Initially, you're somewhat slow using it, eventually you get faster and faster. And you reach a level where you're using the product, you're buying the book, you're booking the flight as quickly as you can. And what personalization does for you is it presets some of those things. So the next time you go to book the flight, you don't have to enter as much information. The next time you order the pizza, you don't have to tell them as much about yourself and what it is that you want. Because of that, the experience is more efficient, it's faster, and the difference between these two curves, the difference between the personalized product and the unpersonalized product, is what creates the switching cost. So that's sort of the idea that we're working from.
Is that what?
Yeah, sure.
Is it important that those two minds are that large at the end? Or could it be, for example, that over enough trials they're the same, that there's a switching cost that's created much earlier in the curves?
Yeah. So there's a few things going on. It could be the intercept of the curve could be different, depending on how quickly personalization works in the beginning. It could be the slope of the curve is different. But ultimately, it's very hard for the asymptote of these two curves to be the same if what you're doing in the personalized condition is limiting the number of things that you have to do, the number of actions you have to take as a consumer. So if you have to enter your home airport, who you're traveling with, what kind of meal you like, do you like aisle seats or window seats, regardless of how good you get at doing that, you'll never be as fast as in the case where it's already done for you. Right. So it's possible, but usually the asymptote, the close to whatever the last trial you had with the personalized product is what's going to drive the switching cost. But it could also be in the intercept and slope. Okay, so if you do some learning here, in this case, I'm going to show you the A to B switch a little differently. If you've used A a number of times, and let's say this is a website like Amazon.com, switching to Barnes & Noble is probably not as difficult as was the first time you used Amazon.com. But you probably have a little bit of a bump. There's probably some things you have to learn differently. And this is along the lines of what Mark was just asking, which is if neither of these two websites have any personalization that helps you, once you've used Barnes & Noble a number of times, you're just as fast using it as you are using Amazon. And so there's really no reason in terms of efficiency that you choose one over the other. So your switching cost appears here initially, but if for whatever reason that consumer uses the competitor, uses B a number of times, they're going to get good at using it as well. Personalization is going to be different though, because what Mark and I are just talking about, it gets the asymptote of that curve a lot lower. The not personalized interface, even once you learn to use it, just can't get as fast, you can't get as efficient at using it. So the switching cost is always going to exist. Gerald gave me the 5 minute sign probably about a minute ago now, so I'm going to jump through this first experiment, and then this is really the key probably result that I want to get across today anyway. We did this experiment with student subjects. It was an agent-principal task in that what we told people was, it's your job now, you have a job, and your job is to book a flight for your boss, Mr. Smith. In fact, a number of flights you're going to book on his behalf. He's used this product, this interface before that we're using, so you know this is sort of something similar to Expedia. It knows a little bit about him in one condition. In the other condition, people are asked to use an interface that doesn't know anything about them, so they have to enter all the information. So we have a personalized condition and a non-personalized condition, two groups. One where the website is right from the beginning, it knows a bit about the consumer's preferences, and the other, it doesn't. And then we also have competitor experience. So after they've used this incumbent, either personalized or not personalized interface, they use the competitor one or six times. So maybe to make that a little bit more clear in terms of the procedure, people start, they start with six bookings, flight bookings for their boss, Mr. Smith, either using a personalized or a not personalized incumbent interface. Then they use a competitor that's not personalized, either one or six times. And then we ask them to choose between the incumbent and the competitor. What we're interested in is what sort of advantage personalization can provide over an unpersonalized interface, and also how that advantage might change when you've had more and more experience with other products, similar products. So here's what our flight booking interface looked like. There's a trip from Atlanta to Boston. Sometimes in one condition, a lot of this information was preset. In the other condition, it wasn't. And here's what we find in terms of learning. So the red curves are the personalized interface. So the intercept is lower. Right from the beginning, it's easier to use the personalized interface. And this makes sense. You have to fill out less and less information. The asymptote is lower. So even once these people, which they've learned quite a bit in terms of filling all this information and booking flights, but because the interface hasn't learned anything about what they want to do, they can really only get to about this level in terms of performance. Now they're forced to switch to using a different interface that isn't personalized in both cases. For those people who never had a personalized interface, it's not that much worse. For those people who did have a personalized interface, they get quite a bit worse right here, right? But then they catch up. They learn pretty quickly again. Now based on the switching cost argument I made earlier, you'd expect to see an advantage here for the personalized interface. And I'll show you what we found in terms of choice shares. So for when the incumbent wasn't personalized, we find that just using it those six times before you ask to switch gives the incumbent a fairly strong advantage in terms of choice share of what people are choosing. The personalized interface, I guess the next part is it. So this is when they've used the competitor one time. So they haven't really learned to use the competitor, but they've learned to use the incumbent. And so the incumbent has a strong advantage. But as I showed you in the previous graphs, when they've used the competitor a number of times and now have become very strong at using the competitor, they've learned to use it very well, they're indifferent between the two. What we expected with the personalization, this would be different. And here's what we find. So in terms of when the incumbent interface is personalized and they've only used the competitor once, there's an advantage. Maybe not as strong an advantage as you might expect given how much they slowed down. What's more interesting is when they've used the competitor six times, so now they've learned to use this competitor about as well as they can, but it's not personalized, and the choice share gets a lot higher. So here there's only 14% of the people are not choosing the incumbent, even after they've learned to use the competitor very well. Now, I'm running short on time, so yeah, Mark, okay. So I want to give you just a brief, I guess, insight into why it might be that choice share after one competitor trial was not as large as it should be. Essentially what we did was we ran another study where we told them up front, explained to them what the differences were in the two to make it salient, the advantages of personalization right away. What we find in that case is right after even one trial, 91% choose a personalized interface. So essentially what we're arguing here is that what personalization can do is provide you with some insulation against competition. But of course it has to be salient. And if it's not really obvious, it kind of happens in the background, like you see at some websites where it may not be clear to you how much time they're saving you or how much effort they're saving you. Then you really only learn the advantage that you have from that personalization if you use the competitor a number of times and found out how difficult it is to do without personalization. On the other hand, if you make it salient up front, so maybe through advertising or something along those lines, then personalization can give you a big advantage right from the beginning. And back to where I started the whole talk, this is a type of personalization that's really very simple. It just means pre-setting things like the type of pillow in a hotel room or attaching your pizza order to your telephone number that save the customer time, as opposed to having a deep understanding of what their personal preferences are. And so because personalization in this sort of sense can decrease the asymptote of that learning curve, it creates a switching cost, and that switching cost can create fairly strong loyalty. And more important and I think interesting is that insulates the incumbent against competition even once you've learned to use the competitor a lot. So even once you become very good at using the competitor, it actually makes the incumbent stronger because it makes the difference between the two more salient. So I didn't see the last sign, but I think it's probably coming up. Is it time for one question?
Maybe one question while Tony sets up, and then I would suggest that we hold additional questions until the end of the session. All the slides will be up there so we can refer back to them.
The competitor that they were moving to was a non-personalized experience?
Because what we're interested in is, does personalization add anything? Does it help you at all?
Right.
And if the two are personalized, then it's going to become a question of which of the two helps you learn, gets the asymptote of that learning curve lower, and helps you learn more efficiently.
At least we can do this.
Thanks for the presentation. Definitely we're going to be moving tact a little bit, moving into a different area of looking at the internet. Now, a lot of the conference sessions I've seen, a lot of the papers I've seen have really looked at the internet in terms of retailers or technology or operational efficiencies, supply chain, but not too many papers have actually looked at the actual shopping center environments in which we spend a lot of our time and spend a lot of our money, and what kind of impact the internet's had on those environments, and how shopping center owners and developers can actually use the internet strategically, proactively, to, you know, in essence harness the power that they have, which is location. They have locations across the country, they're out there in markets, they're often located proximal to the actual consumer, so they have a lot of kind of already value adds to them. So what I'm going to talk about in my 10 minutes, and I'm going to be quick with this, is I'll essentially talk to you about a survey that we did, and this is a few years back. It ended in 2002, but it's really the only survey of its kind that I'm aware of that looked at multi-channels and their impact on the built shopping environment. I think one thing to really underline is that there's a large amount of grounded capital in the shopping centre environments. You know, we talk about $X billion of e-retail sales per year. There's hundreds of billions of dollars in capital in shopping centres, actually in the real estate investment. That's a massive amount of investment that companies have to deal with. And when you put that capital investment against the year-to-year sales kind of diminish substantially. So the real estate companies and the shopping owners are really there to look at managing the long-term viability of these investments. So anything that's going to actually enhance that is something that they should be interested in. At the turn of kind of the end of the 1990s, there was definitely, or mid-1990s onwards, in the shopping centre trade magazines, there was a lot of fear-type articles about, my God, this is the end of bricks and mortar stores, what are we going to be doing in 5 years' time? And the research that I'm going to briefly outline is actually was funded by the ICSC, and I think International Council of Shopping Centres, and I think that kind of underlies the fact that they're interested in knowing the impacts. Very briefly, the shopping centre industry in Canada is around about 400 million square feet of shopping centres, over 3,000 centres, 115 million square feet of what we call power centres. These are your large format retailers being grouped together. Over the last 10 to 15 years, there's only really been one major shopping centre developed in Canada, at Vaughan Mills on the outskirts of the GTA. And really what's been changing retail from a locational perspective has been the growth of the large format retailers, the category killers, the Walmarts of the world, the Home Depots, the Costcos, and the increasing clustering of these. So just in terms of a few of the companies, and this is a little bit dated because these companies do buy and sell these properties fairly regularly. You can just see actually the number of centres each of these companies operate and the amount of square footage. Now if you can equate that out into billions of dollars that each of these companies are responsible for, and they essentially are in the tenant business where they want to get the best tenants that they can in their centres and keep those tenants happy. There was a real fear at the end of the 90s that the internet would really obliterate the relationship they'd have with these tenants because everyone would suddenly go online and would no longer visit stores. In terms of Canadian internet use, and this is really just a bit of an update, as a country, Canada definitely is high up there in terms of its internet use. This is the latest data out of the Canadian Internet Use Survey, which was the follow-up to the Household Internet Survey. Two-thirds of Canadian adults are on the web. 7.9 million households have internet connections. This sort of varies quite markedly by geography, by age, education. They change the differences in usage geographically. It's the major metropolitan markets have higher usage. Definitely younger age bandings have higher usage, and higher education generally means higher usage. Interestingly, 57% of Canadians were still concerned about internet credit card use in 2005. If we look at what kind of things from the Stats Canada survey that Canadian internet users are doing on the internet, window shopping is really high up among them, 57%, and ordering personal goods or services, 43%. I really don't know what general browsing means, but you kind of work that one out for yourself, but I've got no idea. Okay, so what does this mean for e-retail? So current data says that Canadians are actually using the web to shop. They're using the web also as a window into that shopping experience. So if we actually look at the amount of sales that have been coming through the online channel, The 2005 data is yet to be released. It should be out fairly soon, as far as I'm aware. About $3 billion in 2004, less than 1% of total retail sales in Canada. If we look at the percentage of retailers with websites, that's been steadily increasing. And if you actually look to that number for the major corporate chains, so they are the top 100 corporate chains in Canada, which control over 80% of all retail sales, you'd probably be much closer to 95 to 100%. I can't really think of too many major chains that don't have a web presence. And obviously, I think where in some ways e-retail has kind of been eclipsed. It's been eclipsed by the business-to-business kind of side of things, but it has been kind of steadily growing, but nowhere near as much of an impact as the kind of visionaries of the mid-90s were talking about. So how does this relate to the mall environment? Well, what we did is we ran some major surveys in three super regional centers within the GTA. These were intercept surveys, so that means we actually collared people in the shopping malls, wrote just simple structured questionnaires, a very short questionnaire. For the three centers that we chose, they were all super regional malls, over 1 million square feet each, over 200 stores in each of them. So they were a major node of activity. They were a major draw for retail. Okay, so what I'm going to do is just provide you with some of the kind of findings in tabular format. In terms of number of surveys, approaching 2,000 surveys across these 3 miles, which is a very healthy sample size. And what we did is we mixed this between weekday and weekend and tried to capture the ebb and flow of a mall through the week and through the day. We also then geocoded the records of where people came from to get a sense of how far people traveled to these locations, to kind of get a sense of if the internet is so much easier, then people won't want to incur high travel to the regional centres anymore. Well, quite clearly in some of these malls, you've got over a quarter, well, approaching a quarter of the actual shoppers traveling more than 12.5 kilometres actually to get to that mall. One of my colleagues was very keen on calling this masculine and feminine for some reason, male and female. we did have discussions about it afterwards. In essence, just showing the kind of age bandings, and as you'd expect, you know, the 65 and older, but kind of the cohort that's really going to be growing in Canada aren't necessarily out there as much in the malls, and they're often in the malls in the morning because they like the heating and walking around. To do the mall walking. In terms of incomes, they're pretty kind of standard in terms of average household incomes. They're slightly above the Canadian average because this was in the GTA market. What I'll just move through to is reasons for choosing the mall. Okay, so why go to the mall? Proximity was a major draw across these 3 miles, as you can see, 83% for mall B. Mall A, B and C, because we can't, for confidentiality reasons, actually name them. Assortment of stores and services was high. Easy to get to for one of the malls, because that was on a subway link. Some people actually went to the mall because for parking availability. You know, just kind of like to go there because I like to park. And what was the reason, the purpose of the visit? Non-grocery shopping was by far the bulk of that. But browsing was also fairly high. As you can see, a quarter of the visits were just there simply to browse. And this really comes back to the point that Dr. Jones was making yesterday in his concern over the new reality that we live in. A large part of the shopping experience actually is socializing, browsing, spending time, using some of your leisure time. And that's not easily replicated in a virtual environment. How many stores did they visit? The majority visited 2 to 4 stores, and a few of them, a third in one of the malls, over 10 stores. So equate that to the number of websites that you might go to. I think another interesting thing to point out is the amount of time that would be spent in each of these malls. So in mall A, 84% was 84 minutes was the average time spent in the mall, 64 minutes in mall B and 66 in mall C. And think about that as how long people are actually using the internet. And these visits would be, you know, once a month or less. So, you know, there's a fair number of shoppers who are going to spend an hour each week or an hour and a half every other week in a mall looking around the shops, looking at the retail offer. Okay, in terms of access, this was where we became really interesting. What percentage of the mall shoppers had access to the internet? Really high percentages here. 85 and 79. And where do they have access? Primarily from home and work. Home and work and home only were the dominant categories. The two that I think really stand out here, do you check the internet for product information? Well, for one of the malls, it was 8% used it today. But this is where I think is one of the key findings. Do you usually check the internet for product information? You know, over a third, or around about a third, or more, just over a third, across those three malls, we're actually using the internet for product information. Do you check the internet for store mall information? Now, this is one of the things where the mall developers can actually do something. If you go to a lot of the mall developers' websites, you know, and you find out your local mall, they generally only give you maps of location. You don't really get much inventory information. You don't know much of it. So I think there's such opportunity still that remains for the mall developers to actually be far more proactive in the way in which they market their locations through the types of retailers that they have there. So there is really a lack of awareness of the mall sites. And all of these malls had their own websites, and they spent, you know, thousands of dollars on developing them, but there was, you know, 89% of your shoppers don't know about your website, which wasn't a nice finding to have to report back to them. I'll just kind of flip through to one of the slides that kind of tells you a lot about how the mall is actually generating sales generation through dollar transactions. So what we did here is we looked at the possibilities that you can have. You can view online and buy online. View in store, buy online, catalog, view online, buy in store. Look at some of the percentages by categories. 37% of computer hardware was viewed online but still bought in store. 37% of travel, going to a travel agent where you might be looking at travel offers and vacation options. And then we actually turned this into dollar terms. So if you look at consumer electronics, 1.8% view online, buy online, and I presume that would have changed over the last couple of years. A lot of it was view in store, buy in store, but that 8.8 at the end there is, if you take for every, within the consumer electronics category, thanks, for every dollar purchased online, $8.84 were generated through sales of a shopper going online and then buying in store. So this is the conversion ratio. This is the value add of actually having an online presence. And this kind of just turns it into a graphic kind of format. The black line is view online, buy online. View online, buy in store. View online, buy in store. So you can see across a number of categories, it has a fairly significant presence. And then just in terms of some of the reasons for shopping online, competitive prices were still there, being able to shop from home came up strongly, unavailability of products came up quite strongly, and just ease of shopping. Concerns over this for the mall shoppers? Well, just the standard concerns that you have for a lot of internet shoppers. Security was high up amongst that. The issues of returning products, if you had to send them back through mail, etc. So, just in terms of this research, I think we're definitely at a period where we should be revisiting this and actually do a longitudinal survey and go back to these miles and see how it's changed over the last 2.5 years. I think the impacts are multidimensional that we see of the internet. And as Mark Hubbard talked about, this notion we may have moved from multi-channel to multi-touch point. I'm not quite sure what that means. It sounds a little dodgy at some level, but I think the clicks to bricks is quite evident across sectors and within the miles in the survey. There's a role of retail websites as electronic shop windows, and I think currently the mall owners, the developers and the mall managers really need to revisit the way in which they market their locations, because they've got billions of dollars invested in those locations, and I think there's a great opportunity there for some innovative use of the internet. And you know, we're beginning to see some of that with kiosks and wayfinding, but I still think that there's an underlying lack of or acknowledgement of what the internet can actually do for the shopping centre industry. Okay, thank you.
And the one quick question for us.
So you were saying that you might want to go and do the survey again and see what has changed in the last 2.5-3 years.
Yeah.
What sort of do you expect for prognostication on that?
I think that there's probably going to be, in certain categories, you're going to see increased penetration of view online, buy online. So I think definitely with some of the sites, for example, with the growth of manufacturer to consumer sites, you're going to see, you know, the likes of the Dell sites where they're going to have an impact on computer hardware. You're probably going to see a difference in travel related, because the last few years have seen definitely more integrated and sophisticated travel sites. So I think that would be one of the big changes. In terms of the amount of dollars, the view online, buy online, I think the view online, buy in store, I think is still going to be big business and a really big potential for the shopping centre industry.
So that's one of the big concerns, I'm sorry, just a quick follow-up. One of the big concerns is this view in store and then buy online, where people just go look at the stuff and then go order it online. In the old survey, there was hardly any of that happening.
Yeah.
And that's what people are going to look at.
Yeah, I think that's going to be another move where if you see like the tangible, and that comes down to the whole price difference that you're going to get. If there's any price difference from shopping around on the internet, you know what the product is, you know what brand it is, you know the product ID, the exact thing you want to buy, and all you're interested in is you've seen it tangibly, I just want to get it at my doorstep at the cheapest price.
So how many of the malls have increased their investments over this period of time?
In terms of?
Building new stores, upgrading the mall facility, in other words, protecting their market share. These particular three malls that you're aware of.
One of the malls has gone through a major renovation. I mean, all malls go through their life cycle. Every 10 to 15 years, you reinvest and you, sometimes it's just putting a bit more paint around. Other times it's actually expanding the mall footprint. But there hasn't been any major internet integration within those malls. So there hasn't been any major kiosk integration or harnessing the potential of the internet in any way. It's really been about trying to really facelift. Yeah. Okay, well, let the other speaker.
Rob, you got 30 seconds.
Okay. Very quick question. My ethics review committee made me take a permission from the mall before I collected data from consumers in the mall, and I have been turned down. This is the third time I've been turned down the mall, mostly because they have exclusivity contract with some market research firm.
Okay.
Did you have any?
We were fortunate.
Sorry, Rob.
In terms of access to the mall is the biggest problem.
Yeah.
Anyone who studies retail location can talk about the times where they've either been thrown out of the mall by security or for some of my colleagues arrested. So actually running surveys in there is a real issue. We were really fortunate that the malls that we ran into were actually, there's been a long-standing relationship with the CSEA, they've been members of the CSEA, there's a trust relationship there, and that gained us access.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll talk about some joint work with my colleagues Benedict Allaire from Erasmus University in the Netherlands and Murad Usta, who's a doctoral student in marketing here. And what I'm going to talk about is a little bit related to what Kyle was presenting this early this morning, in that I'm interested in an effective personalization, some kind of personalization that can either take the form of what Kyle talked about in terms of a website or a firm learning about a customer from observation, or can actually have a dialogue with the customer and elicit some preferences and then personalize the shopping environment on the basis of that. And the focus of this work is on how does personalization of either of these types affect decision outcomes for consumers. So I'm interested in consumer decision making and the quality of their decisions. And what we propose in this work, and I'm going to show you the results of two experiments that sort of test this prediction, is that personalization or personalized advice, sort of decision assistance to consumers, can have ironic effects in that it can help them objectively do better, make better decisions objectively, but at the same time make them feel worse about those decisions. So in other words, their appraisal or satisfaction with the chosen alternative can decrease, and ironically it can decrease more the better the personalization technology works, and I'll tell you why in a minute. So just for a little bit of background, the kinds of decision advice to consumers that I'm talking about is what we usually call personalized recommendations. So it's a form of personalized advice about choice alternatives. An example would be a realtor who, rather than having the consumer search the entire market of available homes, actually constructs a personalized set of match of homes that match the consumer's preference. So that would be one example of personalized advice about the set of alternatives. Now, this can be this kind of assistance can be provided by a human, such in the case of a realtor or a salesperson in a shopping environment, or it can be a computer-based decision aid. And we usually call these recommendation agents. Again, they can be based on different sorts of inputs, merely observation of what the consumer is doing, or they can be based on collaborative filtering where information is pooled across consumers, or they can be what's often called feature-based or attribute-based, where there's actually some preference elicitation that takes place. I'll show you an example of that in a moment. And based on that, the store or the interface presents personalized recommendations based on its best guess of what the consumer's preferences are at the moment. So there's been some work that has shown that decision advice of this sort can significantly improve the objective quality of consumer decisions. In other words, people choose objectively better alternatives. And Valerie Tripps and I are amongst some people that have contributed to this literature. However, there is some evidence that suggests that there is no evidence, at least no positive influence of such decision advice on subjective decision outcomes. So people don't actually feel more confident that they've chosen the best alternative. They don't feel as satisfied with the alternative that they've chosen. And so what we propose in this work is that personalized recommendations can in fact have separate and opposing effects on objective versus subjective decision outcomes. So here's, I'll just mention, you know, refer to this very briefly. This is sort of a conceptual model of what we think is going on. So basically, providing personalized recommendations, we argue, can have can affect subjective decision outcomes at the bottom right side of this graph via two paths. One is sort of the more obvious one, which is, you know, if a realtor does a really good job searching the market for you and presents you with the set of homes that match your preferences best, then it will tend to improve your objective decision outcomes. You're going to find a better home in our example, and that in turn should have a positive effect on how you feel about that outcome of your choice. However, there's something else going on with personalized recommendations that's important here, and that is that, and I'll talk about the specific properties of personalized recommendations in a moment, but we argue that they tend to increase the difficulty of choice. So, and the better the personalization works, the harder it's going to be because the alternatives that are presented to the consumer actually seem almost equally attractive. So we argue that that increases choice difficulty, which in turn will reduce people's confidence in their choice. So it just gets harder, and so you're less confident that you've actually made the best purchase decision. And then we argue that that in turn also contributes to the satisfaction with the chosen outcome, only not negatively. So there's sort of these competing forces of objective and subjective decision outcomes. Quick clarifying question.
On the subjective outcomes being negatively impacted. Could also be that consumers are feeling that there's sort of a hidden agenda behind these recommendations. So like a salesperson is recommending something to us, and even though the recommendation is a decent one, we might think, oh, he's just selling what he's getting a commission on.
Right.
So is that sort
of, I think that could be going on in the field. I think that would be an effect that's outside of what I'm going to be studying here, and certainly in our experiments, that wouldn't be a factor, I don't think. But I agree that in the real world, that may be going on as well. It's sort of, what's your agenda exactly? Are you really working for me? Or, you know, it's sort of a question of incentives and incentive compatibility. That, I think, is sort of a separate phenomenon that's going on in the real world. But I think we can isolate that here. Okay, so, just a quick example of one of the instantiations of personalized advice that I'm talking about here. This is an example from Yahoo's shopping site, where this is an example for PDAs, as you can see. And so the idea is that shoppers can enter their attribute preferences over here in terms of some key features of this product category. They submit those, and then the interface will produce a sorted list, will produce personalized advice to that consumer based on his or her preferences. And so it produces this sorted list. And so let me talk about what the underlying fundamental properties of this kind of advice are that we argue will influence subjective decision outcomes. So here they are. So the first feature or property of personalized recommendations is that they selectively draw attention to attractive alternatives. Clearly, when you tell Yahoo what your preferences are for PDAs, at the top of the list will be those things that really closely match your preferences. So it selectively draws attention to the good alternatives, sometimes to the complete exclusion of the unattractive ones, or at the very least, there's a gradual shift of attention towards the better ones. Secondly, the recommended alternatives, so those that are sort of in the first screen or in the recommendation set, tend to be close in attractiveness. So I'll show you an example or a graphical illustration of that on the next page. But simply because the interface is trying to match your preferences and identifying the most attractive products to you, given your preference, as a result of that, whatever the system shows you will actually be very close in terms of the subjective attractiveness of those alternatives. And finally, often this is the case with personalized advice, alternatives may be presented in a sorted list. It's not necessarily the case, so the realtor may not necessarily go from, this is the best house for you and this is the second best, so they don't necessarily have to be sorted, but they often are sorted, like in the case of Yahoo. And we argue that in that aspect further aggravates the problem of decision difficulty. So just to illustrate, if you consider a random search, where this would be the display position of products, so if I showed you PDAs in some kind of random order or in a store pre-configured order that doesn't reflect the consumer's preference, you might see a pattern that looks like this, where on the y-axis I'm showing the utility or attractiveness to the shopper of these alternatives. So it would sort of go up and down and up and down like in a traditional random search. By contrast, if the interface has learned the consumer's preference in some way and then sorts the alternatives based on that preference to the consumer, the utility pattern is going to look something like this. And so this sort of illustrates the properties of personalized recommendations at the bottom, which is that there's a selective shift of attentions towards the more attractive alternatives at the expense of less attractive ones. The alternatives tend to be close in attractiveness, and if they're actually sorted, like in this example, that makes it even worse because the adjacent alternatives are really, really close in terms of subjective attractiveness. Okay, so in terms of how these personalized recommendations affect subjective decision outcomes, we're going to focus on two key measures. One is confidence in choice, so how confident consumers are that they've chosen the best product available, and secondly, how satisfied they are with the chosen alternative. Sort of a subjective or experienced utility of the chosen alternative. So we're going to try to disentangle these potential effects of the properties of personalized advice. So the first one is, as I mentioned already earlier, lack of exposure to unattractive alternatives. So if I get personalized advice, I never see the really, really lousy alternatives. Lousy, not necessarily objectively, but in terms of my subjective preference. And so how is that going to affect subjective decision outcomes? Well, one thing that's going to do is it's going to reduce the ability of consumers to engage in counterfactual reasoning. So people tend to compare what they choose to what they haven't chosen but was available. And so one of the things of personalized advice is that it sort of prevents that kind of counterfactual reasoning from happening, because all the alternatives are looking really good. I never compare the chosen house to the really, really bad one in a really bad neighborhood that the realtor never showed me. Another facet is the closeness of alternatives in terms of what consumers actually consider. And so we argue that is a particular instance of what's sometimes called as the too much choice effect by Engar and Lepper and other Barry Schwartz has contributed to this literature as well. So the idea that you can just have too much choice. If there's a choice set that has a lot of really, really good alternatives and there are many of them and it's really hard to decide between them, that will increase decision difficulty and may make you less satisfied with the process and with the outcome. And finally, these effects, we argue, are further amplified if the alternatives are actually sorted. In other words, presented from best to worst in decreasing order. So I'm going to quickly show you some evidence now where we're sort of trying to test our predictions about subjective decision outcomes. So the first experiment, we try to demonstrate the sort of opposing effects that we've argued are present. So that personalized advice increases objective decision outcomes but decreases subjective decision outcomes. What we're going to do is we're going to have an in-the-laboratory study, have people make choices in what we call a principal agent task. Kyle called it an agent principal task. This is the correct term. people are choosing golf courses. So the task in the study is you're working for an organization that organizes charitable golf tournaments in various cities. And so people make a number of golf course choices from sets of golf courses, and they're from different cities. And they're endowed with a preference. So they've been told that the golf courses are presented in terms of four different features, and your supervisor has told you that each feature is important, and in fact they're equally important. This allows us to make statements about objective decision quality. And then afterwards we measure a bunch of things. So people make this choice for a city, they choose a golf course for a city, and then we measure a bunch of things like their confidence in their choice, subjective decision outcomes such as satisfaction with the chosen alternative. Okay, so in terms of experimental design, everybody makes a number of choices of golf courses. We manipulate the following things. First, we manipulate the difference in attractiveness among these golf courses. I'll show you a picture in a moment. What's important here is, so we have a distant and a close condition. And secondly, we manipulate whether or not the alternatives are sorted in the list. I'm going to focus mostly on the difference, the effect of difference. So this was manipulated. Everybody made four choices within subject design. Okay, so this sort of illustrates the key manipulation here, which is between distant and close. So on the left, on the left-hand side here, distant would be a case without personalized advice. So you're seeing a bunch of golf courses that you've somehow come across. In terms of subjective utility, they're not all that close. By comparison, the close condition reflects what we call personalized advice. So two things happen here. One is the alternatives are quite close in terms of subjective attractiveness to the decision maker. And this is also common with advice that's actually helpful, the best alternative is actually better than the best one you would get without advice. So we've introduced a deliberate compound in this design because we want to essentially show that people in this condition make objectively better choices and feel worse about them. And we cross this with whether or not the alternatives are actually sorted. So people saw eight golf courses for each of these four cities that were described in a matrix that looked something like this. Their task was to examine these alternatives and choose the one that they thought was the best for this charitable golf tournament. Okay, let's look at the results. So this is a 2x2 design. We have no sorting and sorting, left on the left versus right, but most of the action is in distant versus close. The first dependent variable is objective decision quality. So we can measure objective decision quality because of the nature of the task that we use, so we actually have a utility score for each of the alternatives. And it turns out, first of all, that people in the close condition, the higher line here, made objectively better decisions irrespective of sorting compared to those who didn't get advice. In other words, who were in the distant condition. Sorting mattered only in the distant condition where it actually improved objective decision quality, but we're hitting the ceiling in the non-sorted condition. Okay, so this is somewhat of a replication of the earlier work, which suggests that personalized advice is actually helpful to consumers. Now what happens to more subjective decision outcomes? So what also happens is that, and this is somewhat of a manipulation check, when the alternatives were close, choice difficulty was perceived to be higher, again irrespective of sorting. Now, what about confidence in choice? So here we get the first reversal. So now the red line is higher than the blue line, meaning that people in the distant condition, so those who chose the worst alternative, were actually more confident in their choice. And similarly, they also felt better about it. So they had a greater satisfaction with the chosen alternative when alternatives were distant than when they were close. In other words, when they chose the worst alternative, they felt more satisfied with it. Yes, Mark?
Did they feel they saw the whole set, though? I mean, just trying, as I looked at the data before, in this case, they feel as if they've seen all the information available.
Right. It was all on one screen, and it was a choice set of only 8 alternatives.
And only 8.
So we had truncation. In other words, the what close means is that the top alternative was better. The alternatives were close, and it didn't go down that far, right?
So what I'm trying to figure out to the personalized systems is, it seems to me the biggest gain of the personalized system is I know there's a whole bunch of stuff that I didn't see, and they got me focused on the right stuff.
Right.
Whereas if I feel like I've seen the whole universe,
right,
I see these results, but I wonder if you're confounding some other aspect of how that choice agent actually makes me confident that I haven't looked at the rest of the world. Whereas if I chose randomly, I'm always constantly worried about what I didn't sample, what wasn't out there.
Right.
So I guess
what we're getting is the opposite of what you're characterizing, which is that this is distance. So this would be the random search. Right. So these people are actually more confident because they
I guess what I'm saying is, are they more confident? Is part of why they're more confident the fact that they're not worried that they're missing something else?
But these are the people that get the advice, right? The close condition is the ones that get the personalized advice. So these would be...
It's the same...
Maybe I can... I'm going to try to mediate.
Javi actually got it. Unlike me, Javi actually got your point.
Go ahead. The worry, to me, at least, is that people only think there's 8 choices out there.
Right.
So that they see these 8 choices that are really good, and think, oh, I chose the top one, but I don't really know if, or the second from the top one, I don't really know if it's the best, because
right.
The 7 other ones seem pretty good.
Right.
Where if you're in the distant case, the one you choose is clearly better than the other ones you visualize.
Right.
So of course you're going to be sort of happier about your choice, because
right.
Your other options just were really bad.
Right.
So the question is, you know, is there a 1 to 8, and then there is a for more options button, click this button.
Right. Well, we've done other studies where we actually manipulated the in fact, study 2 partly manipulates the number of alternatives that are there. But the cover story the cover story in the closed condition was that these are sorted, and it's actually showing you the top 8 golf courses in that city. So there are more out there, but it's showing you the top 8. So maybe that addresses your question as well. That it's a subset of what's actually available in the marketplace. Only that subset has either been drawn randomly or it's been drawn from the top of the distribution.
Okay.
I'm going to have to fly through this. We did some mediation analyses, which is a technical word for trying to understand the process. But basically, we're testing some of the paths that I showed you in the figure earlier. So for instance, the effect of distance on choice confidence is partly mediated by choice difficulty in line with our model. A stronger effect even is that distance affects satisfaction with the chosen alternative through choice difficulty. In fact, when you include choice difficulty in a model, it picks up all the effects, so that the entire positive effect of distance on satisfaction with the chosen alternative is actually mediated by choice difficulty. I'm going to have to fast forward a little bit to get to experiment 2. So, and just give you in a nutshell what's going on here. So basically there are 2 things that we haven't yet disentangled in experiment 1. We sort of demonstrated that we can reverse objective and subjective decision outcomes. What we don't know from experiment 1 is whether that's driven by a lack of exposure to unattractive alternatives, or truncation as we call it, of the choice set, or of the closeness of the alternatives in the choice set that is presented to consumers. So we're going to disentangle that in the following design. So here we have 4 treatments. The first one is quite similar to one of the conditions in the first experiment, which is distant and not truncated. So the alternatives are, you know, quite far apart in terms of subjective utility. And this would be the personalized advice condition, where there's, you know, they're all better on average, and they're closer together. But that confounds distance and the quality of the worst alternative that's shown. So we're disentangling those 2 now by using a choice set that we call distant and truncated. So it's the same amount of distance between the alternatives, but it doesn't go down to the really bad alternatives. And another one that's close and not truncated by having 4 really good and 4 really bad alternatives. And so here are the key results. So in terms of choice difficulty, basically, so this is sort of a test of competing explanations. Is it the distance or closeness of the alternatives that drives the effect, or is it the truncation? And it turns out in this study, it's mostly the distance that drives subjective decision outcomes. So first of all, choice difficulty is higher when the alternatives are close. Moving in the wrong direction. Secondly, and more importantly, people are more confident in the distant condition, irrespective of truncation, compared to the close condition. So there seems to be something about the closeness of the alternatives in personalized advice that really drives down subjective decision outcomes. And we see the same pattern of results when it comes to satisfaction with the chosen alternative. So people, consumers, feel less satisfied with the chosen alternative when it was part of a personalized choice set, in other words, when the alternatives were close, irrespective of how good or bad the worst alternative was that was shown. I think this also addresses, in part, Mark's point from earlier. And then there was a question about whether they would choose the same alternative again, and again, this result suggests that greater distance between the alternatives made people more likely to choose the same one again. So it's another measure of confidence. I'm going to skip through the mediation analyses here and go straight to the conclusions. Kyle showed me a sign that has a minus on it, so I don't know if the number is. So let me wrap up quickly. So first of all, what we show in this work is that personalized recommendations tend to have sort of these ironic or opposing effects. They have a positive effect on objective decision outcomes. So personalized advice actually helps people make better decisions, but at the same time it has a negative effect on subjective decision outcomes. So they feel less confident, and more importantly, they feel less satisfied with what they've chosen. It's sort of an interesting paradox. Moreover, we find that the negative effect of personalized recommendations on subjective decision outcomes does not seem to be the result of a lack of exposure to unattractive alternatives. That didn't have an effect in our studies, but rather it seems to be caused by the fact that personalized advice shows consumers alternatives that are really close in terms of subjective attractiveness. So the differences of the alternatives and the sorting contribute to that. And finally, I kind of skipped over that a little bit, but actually choice difficulty, perceived choice difficulty, is a key mediator of these effects of personalized advice on subjective decision outcomes. Thank you. And now Jack's going to make sense of it all.
Yeah, right. All right. I should preface this by saying all the comments and opinions I'm going to offer are obviously from the automotive sector. So they may be a little different than, say, the retail shopping center perspective or online ordering even. What I was actually asked to comment on was the effect of the internet on buying and selling automotive vehicles, right, to the dealerships. And it has had a profound effect. I agree with the paper entirely, and then it does tend to generate a more profound sense of loyalty with the customer. But keep in mind, too, that the automotive sector in particular is driven largely by branding. People usually decide what they want in the form of a model and then a brand, and then after that they'll look at different ways to procure the item. Now, buying cars over the internet is great in that it allows customers to identify exactly what they want and then build it over and over and over again until they finally see exactly what they want. But it also tends to set the bar unusually high because not every vehicle that you can build on the internet is going to be available at your local dealer. Especially, it is definitely a seasonal thing. Currently we're in the month of October, still in 06, but of course build up for 06 is finished, 07s are on the way. We always have good lease programs and purchase programs on the existing model year. But of course now stock is dwindling throughout the country, so you may not be able to get exactly what you're after. Buyers do tend to feel less confident about a vehicle or an item that they haven't actually had a chance to see, touch, feel, smell. So a small leap of faith is required. And then of course their level of trust will be indicative of how much trust they have in the brand and in the retailer. Meaning if they know what they want on the internet, but then they go to the retailer and, as the gentleman in the back commented, what if that salesman is trying to wedge them into something into stock? Well, in the past, that has definitely been an issue. People tend to have a sense of mistrust about the car industry in general, and as a whole, the retail automotive industry is currently reinventing itself, doing away with a lot of the old timers that have engendered, a sense of distrust. However, nowadays, what we're seeing is the the salesman is identifying the fact that he's going to see you again and again and again. And if he does it correctly with you, he's going to get a chance to meet your friends and your family. So now he's not looking at the one purchase. He is looking at the lifetime purchase. I don't want to be your single car salesman. I want to be your car guy is what we're seeing more often than not. So they're not going to allow their own sense of greed or impending bills or anything like that overly manipulate the advice they give you when you get to the dealership. In the past, the internet has been a great tool to get people into the showroom because really that's what it's about. Set the vehicle that you want. And then if you have actually personalized yourself, given your information in the form of your name and postal code, that information is going to get forwarded to head office and then disseminated through the dealers. It is going to be obviously first given to the closest dealer, depending on the area that you live in. And then after that, it'll be sent to other further places anyway. It is up to the retailer to then contact that customer and get him down and find out exactly what the person is after and if he can help him or not. Now, an unusual option that may have been previously unconsidered on the internet or in person can suddenly become something that is incredibly important. And this is where the internet can make things difficult sometimes. If you can get somebody to come down and look at something that is very, very close to what they're after, but maybe a little bit different, this can either help the customer or you can shoot yourself in the foot. It depends on really what that person's motives are and how important each individual option is. Price is always going to be a factor, of course, so you're going to find people constantly making that justification decision in their own mind. I really want a sunroof, but I don't need leather. Right? If you can, of course you're going to take everything, but if you can't, you have to weigh each decision very carefully against your own budget restraints. So several interesting points that I noticed in the paper was the introduction and effective use of the internet has created more loyal and profitable buyers, which is true. When people have designed their own vehicle and they know that they're getting exactly what they want, price becomes less of an issue. It really is about the personalization and do they feel that they've actually been catered to and had all their concerns met, all the questions that they had answered. Now, price is always going to be an issue, of course, but again, when you have exactly what you want, it's not going to be as important. People will usually long remember the good service or the bad service long after they've forgotten about the price. Most people can't remember what they paid for a car 3 years ago. Let's see. Now, the assertion that the ease of use and repeated use of a vendor's website will cause a significant gain in the market share. That is true. But you've got to keep in mind that most of the manufacturers now are pretty good at designing their websites, making them easy to use. However, what you will notice too is that a lot of customers, they get very frustrated. If they're not able to do exactly what they want, they either assume the site's not working properly or they just can't get what they want, in which case they're not going to make the phone call. And that is all about the sale. The first phone call, the first initial contact is going to create either good, long-lasting customers or you will create a person who will never visit your site ever again. Now, they will find comfort and assurance from a site that allows them to accomplish the task easily. Most of the websites designed nowadays to design your own car, they're called car configurators, are fairly simple to use. There are limitations on what you can do, of course, and these are going to be designed literally by each individual country. Every country orders its own cars and sets its own requirements for that entire region. Meaning we can get certain color combinations here in Canada that they can't get down in the US. They can get certain options down in the US that we can't get here in Canada. And that is because the people that are in those positions within each automotive manufacturer have decided what is going to be popular in that region. Not everything works everywhere. So, now having said that, there are always valid ways to pursue a specific individual widget or gadget that you want, i.e. you can pay a special order fee if you want to have something added or subtracted. But the automotive manufacturers nowadays are realizing that vehicles are built to last. They are going to last long after the initial use is gone. So they have to make sure that a vehicle is always resellable, remarketable. It's going to be appealing to not just one person on the planet. So they're not going to really encourage you to build a really ugly vehicle or something that is only going to appeal to you. Most vehicles nowadays, especially in the brands that I represent, 80% are leases. Which means 8 out of 10 cars are going to be on the used market in 3 years. Not that many people keep their vehicles for 10 years anymore. It just doesn't happen. Income levels raise and technology changes at such an astounding rate that not many people are interested in driving a car that's over 4 years old. And here in Edmonton, I think that's more obvious than anywhere else. Now, one of the comments that I did read in the paper, buyers seldom have well-defined preferences. And this I find to be true probably about half of the time. They usually come in, they have a fairly good idea of what they want. Excuse me. Sorry about that. But they will always accept, you know, the possible deal on something that's in stock, as long as it's close enough to what they're after and they feel that there's some kind of advantage to them. The car industry in particularly, it's the, one of the last two products that you're able to bargain on acceptably. That, you know, cars and houses, of course. It is still considered acceptable to come in and make an offer on MSRP, whereas not many people would do that on, say, a pair of jeans or a CD in the store. And yet, for some reason, in the car industry, because it's been part of the tradition, that will always be ingrained in every retail sale. So you have to always weigh that against what you really want. If you came in, you said to yourself, I am not going to go above $500 a month, and I am not walking out of there with anything less than black on black, well, before you know it, you're driving home in a blue car at $750 a month, and you're delighted because somehow you saw the value in the purchase that you made. If you came in thinking, I'm going to buy black on black, I'm going to get $500 off, get my $500 payment, and I'm happy, well, now you've actually gotten $3,000 off on a vehicle that you didn't intend to look at, and you're twice as happy. Every vehicle purchase isn't just about the item that you bought, but it's actually about the experience. It is about the event, the deal. The deal is always going to be part of every transaction. Now, having said that, of course, a lot of your internet shoppers are more technical buyers. They're more interested in, what am I going to get? I'm going to get exactly what I want. And then price becomes less of a part of the equation because they're really, really determined to get every specific need that they had met. And beyond that, well, I'll worry about that. Okay? But people like that, too, suddenly come to start to modify their choices depending on what is available to them. So, internet cars and procedures, personal orders also slow things down. The car industry in general is a very emotional business. Every decision requires a certain amount of emotional investment. If there wasn't any emotion involved, if it really was all about need, I think everybody here would be driving Honda Civics. But that's not the case. Most people have a certain amount of their own desires or ingrained personality in the vehicle that they drive. Everybody knows this. This is something that's, you know, it's no big secret. People will pay more for what they want to look like and for what they want to enjoy. I don't need a steak dinner, but I want to drive a convertible. You know, everybody has their own set of priorities. So the car industry, more than most, is driven by this kind of emotion. So, let's see. Yeah, I don't need this widget, but I certainly want that gadget. As cost plays a part in every decision, the addition of any feature also becomes a question of personal justification, whether they're willing to pay for the extra feature that they really feel they need. You'll also see the tuner market is actually a perfect example of that. You get young kids who can't afford a vehicle beyond, say, $8,000 to $10,000, and then they wait and spend another $8,000 to $10,000 in rims and paint and spoilers. These cars aren't now worth suddenly $20,000, okay? That's thrown away money, but again, it's all about image and perceived status in their own circle of friends. Okay, the internet allows prospective customers to tailor to make a potential car suit their needs and wants. However, this is always going to be weighed very carefully against cost. People will always reach a little bit higher, too, for something that they want. They assume that, well, it's $53,000, I'll get it knocked for $3,000 off. Well, it doesn't always happen that way. Now, people will start to make decisions as to, well, let's see now, what do I really need in this? What do I really want? And what am I willing to give up? So, required features suddenly become a little bit less important if somebody is more driven by their own budget restraints. Okay. Now, more important, especially in the internet, the impact of the visual representation is huge. That is the single largest factor that we've seen from the internet. It gives the customer the ability to actually look at what they're thinking about buying and picturing themselves in it. Again, because the car industry is such an emotional business, they need to be able to visualize what is it going to look like with me driving down that street in that car. What are my neighbors going to see when they see that vehicle in my garage? What kind of image am I projecting when I make a $50,000 purchase or make a $20,000 purchase? What are the two options? What am I going to really say about myself even when I'm not really intending to say anything? These are the kind of things that enter every car buying decision, and of course they have to be capitalized on right away and understood by, you know, a savvy salesman anyway. Now, the personally designed and ordered car has a higher perceived value because now the person who orders that car is going to ingrain in the vehicle a little bit more personality. They're going to identify themselves into that car as much as the car onto themselves. If it's a vehicle that they have personally designed through the web configurator, now they're going to be more loyal to that vehicle. They're going to see that vehicle as really a child, almost, as something that they have decided to birth, because if it wasn't for them, that car would not be here. Their loyalty to that vehicle, that one specific car, is going to outweigh most other vehicles on the road. They're going to feel more guilty if that car breaks down. They're going to be ashamed if that car is banged up in an accident. Whereas somebody who walks into the dealership and just buys a car off the floor, that becomes what they encounter with that car. It's the deal. I bought the deal. Okay? The deal is a fantastic story as well, and that will tell you a lot about the buyer. What is more important? Is it the car or is it the deal? The people that really go after the deal, it's really about the numbers. Okay? Do they get enough of their basic requirements met, and then did they get the deal that they wanted on the vehicle? So now if that car is stolen, or banged up in an accident, or scratched in the parking lot, they feel less emotional attachment to that vehicle, and somehow they deal with it a little bit better. The vehicle that was personally ordered and built, more often than not, that person's going to buy out the lease, they're going to own it for longer than 3 years, they're going to want to sell it to a friend because they want to see that vehicle around, and any kind of repairs or anything like that will be addressed almost immediately. Yeah. Yeah, it also helps hold the value in the resale car. Because there is no used car factory, when that vehicle is on the used market again, and it is a more of an individual car, the next buyer is also going to see that as more of a unique child again. They're not going to see it as just a bread and butter car that somebody, you know, simply bought off the lot. Now, the cars can be the adult equivalent of the child's personalized teddy bear. What the car says about the owner has a greater bearing on the decision to buy than any other single factor. Now, where Mini, in particular, Mini and BMW, offers a multitude of choices and decisions regarding color, options, interior, components that are in the vehicle, Acura, say, as one competitor, offers very few. They offer a choice of 4 colors, 2 transmissions, 2 trim levels, that's it. So in that market, that particular buyer is always going to be more attracted to that Acura car because they're more concerned about not being bettered or lessered by their fellow man. They want to make sure that I got exactly what my neighbor got, and I paid exactly the same thing. It removes any kind of integral competition between the buyers. And those kind of buyers will be loyal to that type of philosophy. BMW and Mini, obviously, we are on the other end of the spectrum. We like the individual cars. We like people to feel more of a personal endowment in their vehicles, personally ingrained personalities in the cars. They tend to love their cars a little bit more, they tend to enjoy them, and they enjoy telling the story about how they came about the car, too. And this will actually foster a more familial sense at the dealership. We get a lot more devoted car buyers at our dealership. Loyalty is definitely much higher than they are in some the domestics or in some of the Japanese brands. The decision to buy a new vehicle is always a very stressful one, although it should not be. New car day is supposed to be a fun day when you finally allowed yourself to make the leap, spend the money. More often than not, though, customers come in and they're completely stressed out. Industry papers have always indicated that the average buyer will buy at the third car lot, though 80% of them will buy that day. And even though the third place that they go to may not even be a product they're remotely interested in, they're just tired. They've had enough, they don't want to meet anymore, they've had too many decisions thrown at them to begin with, so suddenly they'll start to tailor what they want to their time constraints. And I don't want to go home empty-handed, and I don't want to meet anybody else, and I don't want to get any more phone calls. This is very much a part of the industry. That is why it is ever more present to be on the ball when they first come on. You want to make sure that customer feels catered to, helped, friendly environment, and that they've had all their questions asked. Otherwise, you'll never see that person again, and that's the death of any car business. That's about all I have right now. You have any questions at all? Yeah?
Yeah, I know that, Chuck. I'm just putting my own car buying experience. I'm in a little town in Indiana, and there's almost no competition, and they can charge anything they want. But if you drive an hour, you can hit Chicago, mm-hmm. and there's fierce competition. I know that when I buy a car, I now put it into AutoVitel, and I put in all the features that I want, you know, mm-hmm. and AutoVitel lets you do that. And then they'll tell you where you can pick up cars like that.
Sure.
And then I call them, and I say, I call the dealer, make sure, hey, save the car for me, and
is it there?
Around when I get there. It doesn't be mad if you do and leave, but
right.
You know, because you have to be there. But the thing is, I was wondering, doesn't that have an impact on your sales too?
Absolutely. Search engines that lump brands together are the they're very detrimental to our business. Because of the problem, it's a very one-dimensional image. If I can get air conditioning, power windows, sunroof, leather upholstery, and they all look the same, they all look good, well, the Hyundai Sonata, why is that any less than the BMW 3 Series? And look at the price. Now, the problem with that is that without touching and feeling and smelling the vehicles, and actually ingraining a little bit of personality of your own into them, imagining yourself behind the wheel, it can be misleading. If you just make it about looking on the internet, it's going to be largely price. And especially most of the search engines will categorize things by price. So the more inexpensive unit is going to appear first. So if you're really just comparing options to options, it's hard to identify the value. And the value is the actual quality of the unit.
Do you have anybody who looks first? And this is what I do. Mm-hmm. I look around at the car dealerships locally to find the car that I do feel the most comfortable with, and then I go on the internet to see.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of people, they'll phone in and they'll say, do you have this unit? I don't want to talk to anybody. I don't want to hear anything. I just want a yes or no. Do you have the unit?
Right.
Right? Or people that come on, they look around. They don't want to talk to anybody again. They just want to see what's on the lot, and then they go home and start to search. Now, searching again is... it's great because it gets people into the car buying mode, and it's going to give us an opportunity to meet you and get you in the door and hopefully show you everything, give you the service that is going to make you feel confident to make your purchase at my store. But there's always going to be other websites out there too saying, drive 5 hours, save 5,000.
Right.
Right? Now things like that are misleading. The problem is that everybody pays the same for the cars. There's no rocket science here. It's not like I'm suddenly able to magically wave a wand and I'm going to pay $2,000 less for the car than say Bavaria does. We pay the same. It's how it's marketed, and then what is promised to you to get you in the door, right? They say, I have that car. Absolutely. Come on down, okay? But you get there, oh, well, sir, I sold it 10 minutes ago. Perfectly valid reason. This is going to happen. This will happen. But again, that's not to say that you're not going to have a pleasant experience. He may have something that's exactly what you want. It's in blue instead of black, but maybe it has one extra widget. Well, what if I can throw that widget in? Now you've gotten everything you wanted, and you got a great story. And that's always part of the car business. Because cars have so much of our personality and individuality ingrained in them, the story becomes a huge part of every car buying purchase. Anything else?